nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, what I want to do today is overview high-resolution imaging, both via the standard high-resolution TEM mode as well as the scanning transmission electron mode. And again, these are overviews. I'm going to do both of these in an hour so you get a sense, so that you have some sense as to how the images are formed and what's involved in interpreting them. So we'll just dive on in. The idea, we all see high-resolution images showing up in journal articles. We see what appear to be the atom positions showing up in an image. And what I want to do is give you an interpretation or an understanding on how to interpret those types of images. The idea with the high-resolution image is that if we have some sample which is very thin meaning within a single scattering thickness, on the order of 100 to 200 angstroms in most cases, the idea is we take in an incident electron wave. I'm representing it here just by showing straight lines for equal points on the wave in terms of the wave, peaks or troughs, whichever you want to choose. And then once the wave comes into the sample, it's going to interact with the sample and come out the other side. And when it does so, you'll have one beam that's transmitted through, and then you'll have other beams that are diffracted by the presence of the atoms in the crystal and the coordination of the atoms and their location. And so what happens is as you have the wave come out of the sample, you'll have a series of waves resulting, one being the direct transmitted wave and a series of diffracted waves depending on the particularities of the sample itself. And so if you look at, if you were to just simply stick a piece of film here and look at the interference pattern between these, you would find that you have contrast that results due to cancellations that occur caused by the different phases of the different electron waves. So you basically are using the sample to bifurcate or to multifurcate, to change an incident single wave into many waves. Each of those waves is going to have its own phase depending on how far it traveled in the crystal and how it interacts with the crystal, and thus the phase contrast image that you see is a result of that interference pattern in the far field due to the difference in phase between the transmitted and diffracted waves. So these things, and if I just show there with yet another, there's multiple diffracted waves, and the entirety of the image comes from that interference pattern. This is an image here, a beautiful, one of the most beautiful micrographs I've seen in high-resolution microscopy. This is looking at a piece of aluminum over a very large distance. It has a particular orientation so that you can look down two different crystallographic orientations and look at a grain boundary. This is a special boundary, a sigma 9 boundary, and we're looking along 110 type directions in this crystal, and they're separated by a boundary with a particular angle between the two grains. So what you're seeing here is you're seeing a series of white dots. We can magnify a region of this. I'll take a central region of this and magnify in the next image, and you're seeing a series of white dots surrounded by black space. The easy interpretation of this is, what we're doing is taking a picture of the atoms. The electrons come in, see the atoms scatter off of that, and that's why we see what we see. That's an inaccurate interpretation because there's much more going on. But this image does reflect the internal crystal structure and the symmetries of the internal crystal structure. This image was likely taken at a particular defocus where, in fact, the areas that are black represent where the atomic columns are, and the areas that are white represent where the atomic columns are not. That's called the Schertzer defocus, and that's a standard defocus condition. And what we want to understand is how focus and sample thickness and different effects lead to the patterns that you see and the images that you see. All right? But again, the general idea is that we have some wave come in, it goes through and has a particular interaction with the atoms in the crystal. The result is on the other side of the crystal as it transmits through, there's a direct wave and a series of diffracted waves. We collect all those, let them interfere, and that forms our image. That's the overview on how this works, okay? Now, the obvious question is why would we expect to see different phases as we look at the wave that comes out the other side? A naive but somewhat intuitively correct interpretation is that if you have one wave that comes into the sample and is transmitted through continuing along the optic axis, and you have other waves that diffract at particular angles resulting from the presence of the crystal structure, those diffracted waves will travel a slightly different distance in the crystal, and so they will have a slightly different phase on their exit from the bottom crystal surface. All right? So that makes some intuitive sense, right? In other words, we have phase changes because the diffracted waves are traveling different distances. It's not accurate, but it's not a bad way to think about it. And if you, you know, use that thought for kind of an introductory way of thinking about it, it'll get you a little distance. That is in fact a very simplified explanation, and the more detailed explanation that is that as the electron comes into the sample, it has to react to the presence of the atomic potential of all of the atoms that are there, and in particular directions associated with the d spacings that are present, the particular atomic potentials that are present, the electron will find solutions to the Schrodinger equation that exist. And then those particular directions give particular diffracted waves, and the phase that results on the other side is a result of the different population of atoms on different planes. So the true understanding of this requires us to understand how to solve the Schrodinger equation for the electron in the crystal in the presence of a periodic potential, and understand how the phase of the electron wave and the amplitude of the electron wave come out of this solution. Needless to say, this is not a straightforward thing to do, but it is what's going to form the core of much of the class from here on out, is trying to understand how diffraction and images come from the solution of the Schrodinger equation for the electron within the crystal. So again, that should scare everyone on first pass. Anyone who's ever done anything with Schrodinger's equation know that that's not a simple thing to do. So for today, we're going to just think about this more simply and say, look, the transmitted beam comes through, the diffracted beams travel some different distance. You can keep in your mind that really what happens is they have a different interaction with the electrons and with the atoms in the sample. But in the output, the transmitted wave and the diffracted wave have different phases, and those different phases are what interfere to form the high-resolution electron image. Okay? And so that's the idea, right? Wave comes in, thin sample, a series of waves out, interference pattern in the far field, that's the image. So this actually doesn't seem too complicated on first pass, right? In other words, what we would need to do is find a way to solve for the amplitude and phase of the electron waves as they come off of the sample, both transmitted and the different diffracted waves, right? And then we would just interfere those waves to find out the image in two dimensions, okay? That seems relatively straightforward, okay? And of course, that's not that straightforward because this calculation is not that straightforward to do, but it is doable. The thing that complicates things even further and substantially further is that we are operating in a system that has imperfections in the lens that's used to image these electron exit waves, okay? And so if we think about the way that the objective lens works, I've mentioned a number of times that there is a fair amount of spherical aberration present in these lenses. The spherical aberration causes off-axis rays to get focused more strongly than on-axis rays, okay? So if we have some object and we have a series of rays come off, some of which are diffracted to different angles, as you have diffraction occurring to larger angles, those diffracted rays will get focused more strongly than the ones that are closest to the optic axis. And so the simple picture that we just showed of having a transmitted wave and a series of diffracted waves that are interfering in the far field is insufficient, because each of these diffracted waves are going to travel a different distance away from the optic axis, and they're going to feel the effects of the spherical aberration phenomena more strongly. And so the result of this is that spherical aberration causes different additional phase shifts within the electron waves, and so the image that we see has to account for this in detail. In particular, it turns out that the spherical aberration effect on the transmitted and diffracted waves not only changes the phases, but it changes them different amounts depending on the focal length of the electron lens that you're using. So let's think about that. Let's look at this diagram. If we have a given spherical aberration coefficient, we're seeing that the result is a lack of ability to take a point in the object and create a point in the image plane. If we are focusing the lens differently, then we're going to see that these rays are focused more strongly or more weakly, depending on the current going through the lens. But as you might expect, the spherical aberration would depend on the strength of that bend. And so, not only do we have these phase shifts occurring merely because of the spherical aberration, it's also convoluted with the particular defocus that we've chosen to use. Okay? Now that should sound pretty complicated, and it in fact is pretty complicated, because what this means is it means that the image that you see, if we look at a standard high-resolution image, depends very strongly on the exact focus condition that you use. And in fact, depending on the defocus, you can change the look of this image very dramatically. And so just because you see white dots on a black background, there's no ability to say that these are the true representation of where the atoms are a priori. Okay? It's a pretty picture, and really that's all it is at that point. Okay? It really is. It's just a pretty picture. So, the question that we have is, what do we do with this? Well, this is a particularly good pretty picture because it was taken at a particular defocus. There's one called the Schertzer defocus, which is readily understandable, all right, and we'll talk about how that works. And also, the other thing that we do is we will go through and do image simulations to mimic the effect of the electron microscope's performance on the image process, and then do matching. So that if we know we have a picture that's taken at a given defocus, and we match it well with a simulation, then we understand what we have in that picture. Okay? So, in short, unless you have someone who has gone through and done proper image simulation, shown you that they've done that in their work, reported that within the journal article that you're reading, if they haven't done that, then basically all you're doing is looking at a pretty picture. Okay? And if they have done that, or they've told you that in particular they're imaging at the Schertzer defocus and blah, 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 then you can do more with that picture and understand more from that picture. Okay? So one of the things in high-resolution microscopy is just be careful and understand that there's various levels of work that one can do. And in order to interpret the images that you're seeing carefully, you have to do more work. Okay, you have to have more of an understanding on how the electron exit wave phases are changed by the defocus positions that you're using on the objective lens. All right, so that forms a core of how you understand high resolution and how you can go forward on it. All right, so again, we move away from the simple idea, and we have to think about the effect of spherical aberration. The complication here is that in order to make the image that you want, you almost have to know in advance of getting on the microscope a couple of things pretty much in detail. It helps to know what your crystal structure is. It helps to know that you have a very thin sample. It helps to know what the spherical aberration is for the microscope, so that you can kind of plan things a bit before you get on the microscope. It's not just that you want to stick the sample in and take a bunch of pictures and then figure it out after the fact. It's actually useful to do a little simulation in advance so that you enter the experiment with some knowledge on how to handle it. Okay? So that's another thing that goes on with this. So if we return to this highly simplified picture of how the high-resolution microscope is, I mean, how the high-resolution image is formed, we now have the idea that the incident electron wave comes in, it scatters from the sample, we get transmitted and diffracted beams. And then the diffracted beams are being changed by the objective lens focus so that the interference pattern in the far field depends on the specific defocus conditions that you're using. Okay? So that's the core idea of all this. Now, let me show you some pictures of this. If one were to not have this problem, if you were to have a perfect microscope that images that electron exit wave and the interference between the transmitted and diffracted beams, you would have an image like the one on the right. This is taken from silicon nitride down a particular orientation, and you're seeing white dots where the silicon is. You're seeing kind of grayer areas where the nitrogen comes off to the side of those silicon dumbbells. But if you look on the left, you see that that image does not depict the crystal structure clearly at all. It's actually a fairly scrambled image. It's a very nice image. It's taken perfectly, but it's chosen at a particular defocus. And so understanding where the atom positions are is complicated by the focal condition that you choose. In modern high-resolution electron microscopy, there are several ways around this problem. Either you choose a particular defocus, this one called the Schertzer defocus, which gives you a more interpretable image, or you take a series of these different images and you computationally reconstruct them to form this electron exit wave, which is now much more interpretable, or you spend more money and you buy a spherical aberration corrector, which you just set the spherical aberration to zero, and you have a directly interpretable image there as well. Okay? So there's kind of three ways around this problem. The cheap man's solution is just to understand the defocal effects, right? Buy a little software and simulate it. The more expensive, the wealthier person's solution is to buy the spherical aberration corrector. But again, this image here on the left, it's a nice image, taken properly, good thin sample, excellent microscope, but it's hard to interpret what we see. If instead we go through and do additional simulation and additional work, we can go through and directly interpret the image. Looking at the one on the right, the reason that this fellow here knows that he has what he has is not only has he gone through and taken a series of different images and computationally reconstructed them, he's also done the same on a simulation. The inset on the bottom right is a simulation from this exact same orientation with a guess as to the sample thickness, with a understanding of the spherical aberration, so that he matches well the actual image with the simulation. And thus he can say the white blobs come from silicon, the gray blobs come from nitrogen, and the same is true in my actual image. Okay? So this is what's required to do high-resolution microscopy properly so that you can interpret the images coming out the other side. Now I'll ask a question. Oh, go ahead, yeah. So you can, and there are several people in the world that have done very nice, successful experiments in high-resolution mode. But it's complicated. What you normally need to do is you need to have a sample, good thin sample. You need to have a very well-designed heating stage, for example, that doesn't have a lot of drift. And you have to work within the Schertzer defocus condition, this particularly interpretable condition, and hope to goodness that your sample stays steady enough to keep that, okay? So it's complicated, it's doable, but not easily doable. You can find examples in the literature, some very nice work from Jim Howe at the University of Virginia, who is the fellow who taught me microscopy. One of the fellows that taught me microscopy. Also, the Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart has a very nice machine for doing high-resolution imaging dynamically, but it's a million-volt machine that was kind of designed to do that. So it's possible, but not straightforward. Okay, just because of problems with drift, problems with sample movement. Okay. The other thing I was going to say is just ask as a question to the crowd here is who, having looked through the literature, has seen high-resolution images with this kind of level of simulation described. Has anyone ever really run across that as you look through? Lior has because he's done some microscopy. Those of you all that are in chemical synthesis, you know, you see these things in the nanowire literature all the time, right? People show a high-resolution image. Usually they do it just to show that they have quote-unquote perfect single crystals, right? And that's okay. I mean, it shows that the small area they're looking at is single crystalline. But often you see this done just rather cursory. Okay? And so the point I want to make is that you can do cursory work if it tells you the thing that you want to know. But if you want to have more of a detail, if you want to look at a picture taken in the high-resolution microscope and understand what the contrast is coming from and assign it to particular atomic species, you do need to go through and do this sort of thing much more carefully using image simulation and a series of images usually as well, okay? So it's just a bit of warning there, okay? Okay. Now, I cannot go into the theory without spending quite a number of lectures. We'll do that in the future, but I just want to give everyone a sense of how this all kind of lays out. The field has described this process using what's called a contrast transfer function. And this idea comes from information theory, electrical engineering people that are dealing with signal transfer and the like. And the idea is that to some extent, the electron wave that comes out of your sample carries a series of bits of information in it about the frequencies of particular atomic spacings in the crystal. Okay? In other words, if you have a given crystal structure with the atoms separated by a given amount, the wave that comes out interacts with that crystal structure and carries the information of those d spacings. The microscope, because of the effect of spherical aberration, will scramble that information further. And what happens is you have different amounts of phase shift caused on different diffracted beams depending on the defocus and the spherical aberration you've chosen. And so these things here are called contrast transfer functions, and what they are doing is depicting more or less the relative amount of information transfer, with one being a perfect transfer, zero being no transfer at all. And it's depicting this as a function of essentially the d-spacing in the crystal. They're usually plotted as the inverse d-spacing. We'll get into why. But what this means is that different crystallographic d-spacings are affected differently by the imaging conditions that you've chosen. So what people try to do is they try to find an optimal focal condition that causes the least of these wiggles in this contrast transfer function so that we have a relatively flat transfer of the information that comes out the other side. In particular, there is a focus called the Schertzer defocus, and it is one that balances very carefully the effects of spherical aberration and defocus to yield a contrast transfer function such as the one on the bottom of this figure here, the bottom right. And if we look at this, this looks pretty good because there's a large range of spatial frequencies. This is shown as plus or minus 2. It's just different ways you plot it. But large range of spatial frequencies over which not a lot of phase change is occurring. And so as a result, if your crystal structure has d spacings that sit within these values in inverse nanometer, then you are able to relatively directly say that those guys are undergoing a particular phase shift with respect to the transmitted beam, and thus your image is easier to interpret. Practically, what this means is that for every microscope, you have a knowledge of the spherical aberration and a knowledge of the wavelength. If it's a 300 kV machine with a spherical aberration of 1.0, you can go through and determine this thing here, the particular focus, the Schertzer defocus, that you want to use. And so practically, you get on the microscope, you find your image, you go to minimum contrast, right, which we've all learned about in the laboratories, and then you hit a button that says, let's call this focus zero. Then you use the objective focus knob to systematically defocus a given amount, 65 nanometers in the case of the Titan, 62 nanometers, I believe it is. And at that point, you will be in this optimum defocal condition, and your images are more interpretable directly. Okay? So practically, when using the microscope, that's how you do it. You start off, you find minimum contrast, and then you go a particular number of defocal steps until you get to the Schertzer defocus and have the most interpretable image. And the outcome of this is really the same as what we saw in the first couple of images. This was an image taken by Uli Dahman at the Schertzer defocus on the atomic resolution microscope at Berkeley. So he went to minimum contrast. He defocused a particular amount, which led to a contrast showing up with the white dots being where the atoms aren't and the black dots being where the atoms are. Okay? And that's a readily interpretable image in terms of high resolution. Okay? Now, that sounds much more straightforward, right? You have something you can see or not see, minimum contrast, and then you simply go through and tune the microscope to the right value. And that works okay. It's even better to go through and take a series of different images around there so that you can, take a look and see which one looks best, which one is most corresponding to your subsequent simulation of what the Schertzer defocus should look like, all right? So generally, when you do high-resolution microscopy, you take a lot of images, you save a lot of images on your CCD, or you take a lot of film plates, and go through after the fact and find the one that quote-unquote looks best and matches well with your simulation of the process, okay? So that's the way high resolution really works, okay? Okay. Some examples of other things going on. These are simulated images, but for all intents and purposes, we can just call them real images in terms of explaining a couple things. As you might expect, if you think about it, the image that you get should depend also on the thickness of the sample. Okay, right? If your sample gets thicker and thicker, then in my simple explanation, right, the diffracted waves are traveling more and more with respect to the transmitted wave, and so the phase shifts should be different. Okay? In the more complete description, it's that the electrons are seeing more atomic potential on the planes from which they're diffracting, and that gives you a different phase shift. But, you know, simple explanation's not bad, right? As your sample gets thicker and thicker, you have a given angle of Bragg diffraction, and you compare the path length of the electron wave between the transmitted and diffracted beam, and it should increase, the phase difference should increase as the sample thickness increases. Okay, so that complicates things even more, right? If we look at the images shown here, right, these are again simulations, but look, this is a simulation for that same silicon nitride crystal down the same crystal direction, and look, this is at 100 angstroms of thickness, and I don't know why the minus is there, I think I made a mistake, I apologize, that should be T equal 100 angstroms, T equal minus 150 angstroms, not T plus 150 angstroms. In other words, I copied and pasted something wrong. But again, if you look, the difference in sample thickness of 50 angstroms, right? Not very much. That's probably, what, 7 or 8 atomic planes worth of sample thickness? Gives us a completely different image, right? The image contains the same symmetry features, right? There's still some sixfold symmetry apparent in each of these images, right? The atom positions haven't changed. It's just the relative thickness that has changed. So that complicates things even further, right? Because you stick your sample in, you do not know how thick your sample is to this level of precision. There's no way, right? You have no idea if your sample is 100 angstroms thick, 120 angstroms thick, 135 angstroms thick. But very small changes in sample thickness can also affect the image that you get out on the other side. Okay? Again, showing strongly the effects of defocus. These are, again, simulations of that same crystal structure. And you see that very small amounts of defocus, from minus 70 nanometers to minus 90 nanometers to minus 110 to minus 130 nanometers, right? That's a very small number, right? You're seeing very, very large changes in the resulting patterns, okay? So, again, all of this points to the fact that to have an understanding of where the atomic positions are, you need to simulate your images and go through and do a good match so that you know what the thickness and focus is, okay? Okay, we'll have a full lecture on image simulation, but the idea of image simulation is that you use a computer to simulate the action of both the sample and the objective lens on the resulting image. The idea is you stick in a model. You say, hey, I think I have silicon nitride. And I think I'm looking at it down the 0001 direction, okay? And it says, okay, and it goes through and puts in those atomic positions as scattering centers with some potential, some associated with silicon, some associated with nitrogen. It then goes through and calculates as a function of thickness what the projected potential would be and, okay, no, wait a second, because first you have the potential in. It goes through and does a, well, there's two ways of doing it. The one I'm showing here is done in a diffraction space. So instead, it calculates a projected potential, and it uses that projected potential as a thing to simulate upon. In other words, what it's going to do now is it's going to say, if my sample is X number of units thick, then I'm going to take a thin slice of this and scatter off of that thin slice, and then just add those things up in space. This is called a multi-slice calculation. And again, lots of detail in here. But the end result is it calculates a diffraction pattern. These diffraction patterns carry within them the amplitude and phase information. And then it takes and modifies that diffracted intensity using the effects of spherical aberration and defocus, and then goes through and it calculates an image out of that. So in each case, what it's doing is it's giving some sense of the scattering and some sense of the microscope performance to give a simulated image out of the other side. okay? And that's what you use to match. Again, lots of detail in there, but I just want to emphasize that this is what you have to do to have an image that means anything, okay? Okay, so that's the summary of high-resolution imaging in a very short look. The point of high-resolution imaging, it's great. You can see where the atomic positions are. You can characterize your sample with a high degree of resolution. The problem with high-resolution imaging is that it's not a directly interpretable image. You have to go through and understand the effects of sample thickness and defocus on the image that you obtain, right? The relationship between these things is complicated. As you saw from just that simple equation I showed for Schertzer dependence, you know, it's lambda to the 3/4, and I even forget. But, you know, lots of complication in that. But if you go through and understand the effects of thickness and aberration coefficients and defocus carefully with image simulation, and you properly match the resulting simulation with the image, you can have something that you understand, and you can point to a particular position and say, hey, that's where the silicon is, that's where the nitrogen is, okay? So that's the way that it works as an area. Now, I don't want to scare people, because that sounds a bit scary, right? All I've done is tell you the problems and difficulties. It's still very powerful. It's the only, you know, one of two techniques, you'll see the next one in STEM, but it's one of two techniques that give you this level of pictures of the atomic structure of a material. And so if that's what you want to know, then it's the technique for you. It's just that you have to do it with some care and some understanding of how the process goes forward. Okay? Now, within the past maybe 15 years or so, there's been more development of a second technique called scanning transmission electron microscopy. This technique, the idea is instead of taking a plane wave, bringing it into your sample, and having it undergo diffraction, you instead take your electrons and you focus them down to a very, very small probe, as small as you can go, and then you scan that back and forth. And so your probe moves back and forth, you align the sample so that you're looking down a particular direction, and the electrons will come in, and where they see an atomic column, they scatter, and where they're in between atomic columns, they don't, okay? The scatter that happens has a strong angular dependence. We learned that in our brief discussions of elastic scattering, right? And so if you have particular elements sitting on particular columns, you will get more or less scattering. If you have a lightweight element, it scatters less strongly to high angle than a heavy element. And so you can form an image by collecting this scatter. It's done with what's called an annular detector, looks like a donut, and it collects over a series of angles the amount of scatter from a given point in the sample. The image that forms is formed just like in the scanning electron microscope by rastering back and forth and counting the amount of signal at each position of the probe. The image on the upper right is showing a grain boundary in strontium titanate. This is almost the iconic image from the people that do STEM in some ways, because strontium is nice and heavy, titanium is nice and light, so it shows very clearly that the white blobs are where the strontium is, the titanium is shown as the dimmer blobs, the oxygen in this case is not visible because it's so small, okay? In more modern versions of the STEM with very nice correction of aberration, you can even see down into the oxygen, I believe, now. Yes, you can, that's right. And so you're seeing here an image that shows atomic contrast, showing the positions of the atoms, and importantly carrying direct interpretable image intensities associated with which atoms are where. Okay? So STEM is very powerful. The other thing that's nice about this is because this detector is a donut shape, the electrons can still also come through the center of that, and if you want, you can do spectroscopy using electron energy loss spectroscopy, and you can even do column by column and point by point collection of the Eel spectrum. So you can say, hey, I'm going to put my probe right here on one of these strontium atoms and measure the spectrum from that atom, and then from that look at how things like local bonding configurations change and give you different spectroscopy signals. So it's a very powerful technique. Okay, and it's something that's advanced pretty rapidly over the past 10 to 15 years. Okay, this type of image is called a high-angle annular dark field image, HAADF, or sometimes called a Z contrast image, because the contrast that you get depends on the atomic number Z, more or less to Z to the squared. Okay? So that's the name for these types of images. Now, you can have a couple of different types of STEM images that you collect. You can have either a bright field. If you want, you can put a different type of detector that detects the direct electrons, or you can have what's called a low-angle annular dark field or a high-angle annular dark field. And essentially, the difference between the low angle and the high angle is how much you, how much spacing, basically, you put in between the sample and the probe, okay? Pardon me, the sample and the detector. These different types of images carry different types of information. Here is shown some images from the Pennycook group of a strontium titanate. Again, they love strontium titanate, but it's because you can see very clearly the heavy atoms and the light atoms, and in the high-angle annular dark field signal, the heavy atoms and the light atoms. And again, the atomic contrast you see depends on the atomic weight. You can do bright field images to take what are essentially equivalent to high-resolution images. There's a theory called the reciprocity theory that says that basically these things are the same thing. It's saying that if you turn the microscope upside down, you see the same thing on the images. That's a poor but simple explanation. And so this looks like a high-resolution image, but it's in fact it's a stem image, and a very beautiful stem image, showing the atomic positions in silicon. It's showing the amorphous region in silicon dioxide, some crystalline region in a hafnium oxide, and some more crystalline region in a polysilicon. The stem technique has become very popular in technology because of the ability to take these nice images of very important materials, namely the oxides that are used as the gates in field effect transistors. So this is an area that Dave Muller, amongst others, pushed very strongly, and is now seeing a lot of use in technology. But again, you know, very nice images of something that's very thin and small. You can also use the low-angle technique to look at things like strain. So this is a similar type of structure where you have an amorphous silicon, silicon dioxide, and a crystalline silicon. And what he's showing is that if you vary the angle of collection in the lower angle, you see the effects of strain showing up. So low-angle annular dark field can be used to do that. Some caution there, that's less easy to interpret, so you need to know kind of how the scattering works in more detail, but it's nice to be able to know that you can do that. Again, another nice set of images that Dave Muller shared with me showing how if you do particular growths, here they went through and did this in, oh God, I forget what the sample was, I apologize, but it was one of the complex oxides, and they did different crystal growth methods so that they knew they had more oxygen vacancies in different regions, and the oxygen vacancies again lead to strain, and so you can see where the strain is or isn't in the different layers because of the ability of this low angle technique to detect that. The high angle technique is a very nice technique because it gives you directly interpretable images. Basically, when you take the picture, if the atomic column's there, you see bright. If the atomic column is not there, you see dark. There's none of this stuff to worry about with spherical aberration effects or defocus effects. And so the image you see is much more interpretable. Here is a high-angle annular dark field image taken from gallium nitride down the 0001 direction. This is the presence of a screw dislocation. Local to the screw dislocation, looks like there's a higher amount of vacancy formation. And so again, you're seeing less scattering potential along the screw dislocation. But you can see very clearly the symmetry present along 001. And if you zoom in, you would be able to see the individual atomic columns here. But again, the high-angle annular dark field technique is very, very nice because of the fact that you have directly interpretable images. Now, that said, it's not straightforward. It takes some skill to develop to get a very small probe and understand your microscope well enough to do that. You have to have an extremely good environment to put the microscope in, because if you have small stray magnetic fields in the room, that'll shake your probe and that'll show up as a scan noise. And by small, I mean if it's 0.3 milligauss, it's enough, and that's a very small number. So you have to have a good environment for your microscope to take these types of images, but they're very nice when you get them. Another example, again, taken from Ilka Arslan. This is, again, looking at looking at edge dislocation cores and a mixed dislocation core. Again, where the white blobs are, that's where the gallium and the nitrogen atoms are. In case this is just where the gallium atoms are, you can see some of the scan noise here. That's just an effect of having a little bit of wiggle in the beam. But again, what's nice about this is you can see where the atomic positions are. and you can make very direct guesses on what the structure looks like. So here this is an edge dislocation core, a mixed dislocation core, and you can say, all right, well, if I have a white blob, that's where an atom is or isn't, and make a model of the structure. Also, if you have in the high-angle annular dark field mode, you can still detect the Eales signal. And so in this case, what she was doing was taking the Eales signal from the different ends of this dislocation core and showing that one end looked kind of like a screw dislocation and one end looked kind of like an edge dislocation, and the stuff in the middle was something in between. And so that can also help you with image interpretation. So that's, again, an example of how this is a pretty useful type of technique. In summary, with the STEM, it's a nice technique, seen a lot of development. The way that this works, you take the probe, you focus it to a small point, it scatters off the atomic columns. The strength of the scatter depends on the atomic weight on the column. You use an annular detector to detect that, and as you scan the probe from point to point, the image you see collects that scatter and maps out that scatter so that you can know where the atoms are. You can form atomic resolution images that are directly interpretable and are very sensitive to the contrast is very sensitive to the atomic position, so that's very, very handy. You can again combine that with Eales for atomic level characterization, and so this is a very powerful technique and one that's seeing more and more application. One final note on this, I've made this sound as though this is a far superior technique to high-resolution TEM, right? I've said all these complications with high-resolution TEM, and STEM looks like, you stick the thing in and do it. They're both complicated. Okay, in terms of running the microscope, you've got to be very good at both. More and more, the STEM had an advantage that the STEM people like to tout, which was this direct interpretability. But what they're finding now is that as they improve their microscopes, they put spherical aberration correctors on there to make smaller and smaller probes. They're starting to see that the images are less interpretable for several reasons. One, they're starting to get so much intensity along the atomic column, they're getting dynamical effects that they now need to understand. They're also putting so many electrons on the atomic column that the atoms are moving on and off the column just from beam damage, and that's something they also have to understand. And so this one here of directly interpretable images is becoming more debatable, I guess, or more an area of study at the most advanced levels here, and that's kind of interesting. But both of these techniques are very, very powerful ways of characterizing a structure at the atomic level, okay? Okay, so those are the two high-resolution modes of use in the microscope. Okay, final lecture next on this today's Wednesday, so it's going to be on Friday, and I'll go through and describe energy dispersive spectroscopy and Eales, and then we'll be done with the overview of TEM, okay? So on that note, thank you very much.